What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We ask the question every day, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? And perhaps you've never even pondered that question. But if you have and you have an answer for it, we'd love to discuss it with you. Pick up the phone and give us a call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we've got a number for you. It's 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985, and you can always send us an email. The email address is ctc@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky, and Ace McKay monitoring our social media. So if you have a question and you're watching us on YouTube, first of all, give us a like and subscribe to the channel. We would love for you to do that. And also, you can text your question to Dr. Anders. Just text your first name, how you're listening, and a brief question to the same call-in number we just gave, 833-288-EWTN. Our host, as he is every single day, Dr. David Anders, how are you?
Jack, a little bit damp, but other than that, doing all right.
Yeah, we're going to wear you out today. You were doing a little TV this morning, do a little radio this afternoon. You're going to need a nap.
I do need a nap. Tell my wife that.
Got an email here from Ben. It says, I'm confused by Dr. Anders' answer to a question today. On tax day.
Okay.
April 15th, about Jesus' suffering on the cross, particularly whether the first divine person of the Trinity, the Father, as well as the third divine person, the Holy Spirit, also suffered while Jesus was suffering. Perhaps I was misunderstanding the answer Dr. Anders gave. Within his reply, I thought I heard him explain that Jesus had one nature. If that is what he said, isn't that the heresy of monophysitism, which held that there is only one nature, that which was divine? According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church and Ludwig Ott, it is a dogma that Jesus has two natures, human and divine, hypostatically united in one divine person. Contrarily, monophysitism taught that there was only one divine nature. Please help me out.
Thanks. I appreciate the question. I am, of course, aware of monophysitism, and I am not a monophysitist. I am a Catholic, and I adhere to everything the Catholic Church declares to be revealed by God, which includes the doctrine of diphysitism, and I reject monophysitism, right? And I think I remember that call, and I think we got into monophysitism, and I think I was pretty specific about why that's incorrect. So the question, original question that prompted my response was whether the Father suffered when the Son was crucified. Now, there was a second century heresy called patripassionism. Patripassionism, which is just Latin for the doctrine that the Father suffers.
Can you be a heresy without having a goofy name?
I'm sure you could, right?
Canonically, it just hasn't happened yet.
Canonically, a heretic is someone who rejects a settled dogma of the faith. And I guess we could go through the list of dogmas and try to come up with, who can we think of that rejected that one and make up a funny name for them? I think one of my favorites is Utraquism. The heresy of Utraquism. That's the those who believe that the laity have to receive in both kinds. Are you an Utraquist? So patripassionism was the heresy that the Father suffered on the cross. It was a form of modalism, the belief that the Trinity, the names of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit, are descriptions of the different modes in which the one God could appear, but not essential to to the inner life of the Blessed Trinity, right? And so obviously if you're a modalist and you think there's no real distinction between Father and Son, that they're just modes or appearances, then then you could reasonably say the Father suffered. But the Church says, no, no. The Father is not the Son, right? These are real distinctions between Father and Son. You know, they're unusual distinctions because they're only distinctions of relation. There's no substantial difference between Father and Son. They share one common essence, but they do differ relationally from all eternity, and hence the doctrine of the Blessed Trinity. Well, the doctrine of the Church is that it is the second person, not the Father, who assumes a human nature and becomes a man. Now, I did not say that Christ had but one nature. I did say that Christ is but one person. And that may be where the confusion comes in. The doctrine of the Church is that Jesus Christ, the man, is one person, in fact, the divine person, who happens to have two natures hypostatically united. And the ability of the person to suffer is in virtue of the person's humanity. So the person who is Jesus Christ has a human nature in virtue of which he can suffer. The Father does not have a human nature qua Father, and thus does not suffer as Father. Now, that's the doctrine of the Church. Now, there's another feature of Christology that, because, you know, when I talk about Jack Williams, I don't talk about Jack Williams's human nature. How's your nature today, Jack? How's that nature coming along? No, how are you, Jack? How is the person of Jack, right? Now, if I say, you know, are you feeling a little ill today, Jack? Well, it goes without saying that the question presupposes that Jack has a human nature. I can predicate things of the person because of the nature. If you were also divine, I could say, how's that ubiquity going on today, Jack? Right? I could speak of the person using an attribute that is applicable only to the divine nature.
You're looking rather transcendental.
Looking kind of transcendental. Yeah. Looking kind of, yes, ubiquitously. A little bit omnipresent about the edges, you know? And so because of that, we can rightly say things of the person, right, that can be predicated of either nature. And so it leads to some paradoxical language, like in particular the affirmation that Mary was the mother of God, right? Because she bears the divine person who is Jesus Christ. And so we can predicate language of each, you know, one or the other. So it's not inappropriate, for example, to say that God died on the cross. That doesn't mean God the Father. That doesn't mean God the Holy Spirit. And it doesn't mean that the divine nature breathed, you know, ceased to be, right? But it's in virtue of his humanity that Christ can die, but it's in virtue of his person that the two are united. So I can speak in that kind of language, and it's intelligible to a Catholic.
It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We've got a great offering for you from EWTN Publishing for the month of April, The Sufferings of the Holy Family, Love and Unity Through Difficult Times. Our good friend Father Sebastian Walsh, OP, dives into sacred scripture to show how the life of the Holy Family speaks directly to our own struggles, offering not guilt, but hope for our flawed families today. In these pages, see how Mary and Joseph reveal the dignity of marriage, the importance of the family in God's plan, and more. Sufferings of the Holy Family, Family Love and Unity Through Difficult Times by Father Sebastian Walsh. It's available now at EWTN's religious catalog. That's EWTNRC.com. Wide open phone lines for you. Pick up the phone and give us a call. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? 833-288-EWTN. Or if you have any question at all about the Catholic faith, 833-288-3986. You can also text your question to that same number. Just text us your first name, how you're listening, and a brief question, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And that's exactly what Stan did. He sent us a text, and he says he's listening on YouTube, and he says, Dr. Anders, do theologians ever address the idea of God's guilt? In other words, do they ever make statements like, I did not have to be born into a sinful world. Why am I responsible for repenting of sin when I was born with a sin nature?
Boy, howdy, do they ever. This is the red meat of theologians. They love to talk about stuff like that, and all day long and twice on Sundays. So let me qualify a couple things in the premise of your question. No Catholic theologian would say, I was born with a sin nature. That there is Protestant language. That is Calvinist language. Now, interestingly, this is kind of an aside note. You know, Protestants and Catholics differ in not only biblical interpretation, but biblical translation. And there are certain Protestant translations of the Bible that translate the Greek word sarx, which means flesh. They'll translate it into English as sin nature. You will not find that in a Catholic Bible. That's not what the text says, and it's not what the text means. But some theologians think, well, you know, we have this sin nature that we inherited. We'll put that in the language of the Bible. It's not actually in the sacred scriptures. The Catholic position is that we have a good nature, a fundamentally good nature, that is weakened. It's weakened, and we need grace to heal it all the way, but that we, you know, we reject this idea of total depravity and everything you do is hateful to God, et cetera, et cetera. That's not a Catholic view. On the idea of God's moral responsibility, yes, absolutely. Theologians do think about that. And there are basically two schools of thought. One that is more Protestant, although there are a couple Catholics that hold this. One that is more Catholic. Here's the difference. It's a problem that was raised before there was Christian theology. It was raised by Greek philosophy. The first time I'm aware of is in the Platonic dialogue, the Euthyphro. And it's the answer to this question. In Plato's case, who was a polytheist, do the gods decree what's right and wrong because it's right and wrong? Or does it become right and wrong because the gods decree it? You follow?
Which came first, right? The chicken or the egg?
Is it, you know, if God forbids murder, for example, does God forbid murder because murder's wrong? Or is murder wrong because God forbids it? In the first case, it would seem that there's some standard of righteousness other than the will of God to which God could appeal. And so there's theologians that resist that conclusion because they don't want to make something outside of God higher than God. The problem with the second option, oh, well, it's wrong because God forbids it, is that it would seem to make the content of morality arbitrary. So God could forbid adultery on Mondays, but he could forbid almsgiving on Tuesdays. And that just doesn't sit well with us intuitively. We don't want to think of God as that kind of arbitrary person. Now, the view that says things are right and wrong because God decrees them. In other words, that you can assign no reason for the will of God other than just God's arbitrary decision, and there's nothing intrinsic about the nature of reality as such. That view is called divine command theory. There, you literally cannot know what's right and wrong, and you cannot have right or wrong apart from the arbitrary decree of God. That's a position that's associated with a great many Islamic philosophers and with a great many Protestant thinkers as well. Martin Luther took that view, as well as John Calvin. Not all Catholics take that divine command theory, but it's a very prominent one in Protestant circles, and it leads to things like, you know, the fundamentalist who takes the verse out of context, lean not on your own understanding, to justify manifestly immoral pronouncements, right? Well, God wants you to do X, and don't lean on your own understanding, trust me in the word of God, and then he demands some enormity from you, right? And that's the abuse of that. Now, here's the Catholic position, and it was basically Plato's position, right? That when we talk about God's goodness, that this is not an arbitrary quality, if we try to dig down and ask, what does it mean for something to be good, right? Well, my wife bought a watch the other day. She didn't like the watch, so she gave it to me. So I'm now wearing a new watch, my wife's ex-watch. Well, how would you define goodness in a watch? Well, a good watch is one that keeps time. Right, it's one that performs according to its nature, to its design, to its finality. It's not arbitrary. I have a pretty concrete notion of what a watch ought to be, and goodness is a watch that conforms to that idea, right? But you know the same thing with any concrete particular, right? You know, with a human being. What's a good human being? Well, a good human being is one that fulfills that which would tend naturally to the flourishing of a human being. And that's something that's not decreed arbitrarily. It's something that you can discern through rational reflection by considering the concept human person, human being. Like, I mean, for example, I look at your physiology and learn something about how you function and figure out that smoking does not tend to your flourishing, or it's going to increase your chances of mortality. So that's not good for a human person. And I can do the same thing with human moral agency. I can look at, you know, human relationships, human rationality. We can sort of hierarchically rank order elements of a human person, from his reason and his will down to his passions and his flesh, and try to decide how, what, you know, is there a kind of optimal balance in there that keeps the whole thing in harmony and working with one's neighbor? And that's obviously where flourishing is found, and therefore that's what's good. Now, here's the interesting thing that Catholics do. They say that whole sort of regime, that way of thinking about the moral good as something that's intrinsic to nature as such, is ultimately grounded in the inner nature of God, who is being par excellence, right? If flourishing is, you know, the fulfillment of being according to its nature, and the source and origin of being as such is God himself, that's just what the definition of God means, then the connection between human reason and human morality and nature on the one hand in God is deep and profound, and in no way is that arbitrary, right? And so, you know, God literally can't will evil because he can't will that which is contrary to his own nature. But neither is evil arbitrary. Now, to the question, you know, well, what about me then? What about my moral responsibility? And, you know, I didn't choose this life, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Catholics also acknowledge that whatever universe God made would have been a good one. So he's not under compulsion to make this universe or any universe. But if he makes any universe, it's going to be good. And the one that he made, for reasons that we can't know, is good. And we can look around and say the reality is good. My life is good. My moral agency is good. And God provide sufficient grace to every single person that they might be saved. He didn't just throw me into the world and leave me to fend for myself. He created me in this world and made a path for me to come back to himself.
Called to Platonic Forms with Dr. David Anders.
Well, you know, it's an important part of the Catholic
Ain't
tradition.
Ain't no doubt about that.
It's an important part of the Catholic tradition.
It's just, you know, it's when you look back at the ancient Greek philosophers, you know, just because of their very nature, they were on to things that they at the time had no idea they were on to.
Oh, that's absolutely
right.
And
the truth is eternal, and that's why these things ring true, even though they may be using different terminology, because they are true.
So, you know, a big difference that I found when I became Catholic from the way I grew up, in the tradition I grew up in, Christians were threatened when non-Christians pointed out to them, hey, you know, you guys are the only people saying this. I found these Buddhists that say this, or I found these Hindus that say that. And we were always kind of on the back foot trying to defend the uniqueness of Christianity against the claim that everybody else was always wrong about everything. And when I became Catholic, and somebody says, well, you know, you're saying this, but don't you know Buddhists say that? We're like, well, heck yeah. You know, we share a common nature, right? Where we share a common nature, we're all going to come to some similar intuitive moral and spiritual judgments because we're all responding to the same fundamental humanity.
If we're not nuts.
If we're not nuts, exactly.
Ryan writes in, how can God's power be his intellect, and does the Trinity disprove divine simplicity?
So in the question, how can it be? Well, you know, I have no idea. I can't fathom the divine essence, and it's hidden from me. I mean, it's a doctrine, it's a dogma of the Catholic faith that we can't predicate univocally of God and creatures. Anything that we say about God is at best an analogy. You know, so we reason our way to divine simplicity, because if God is not ultimately simple, then there is that in virtue of which he is composite. You know, so like if you look at a water molecule, for example, that's hydrogen and oxygen, well, how did those two things get together? Well, it's in virtue of some higher physical principle that you can have the union of two elements and form this new molecule, right? There's something greater than oxygen, something greater than hydrogen that accounts for the union of those two things in a single molecule. If God is composite, then there's something other than God in virtue of which we can explain, you know, the union of those different elements. And so since God is just by definition where the explanatory buck stops, God has to be metaphysically simple. Now, you know, what that means is we experience a bifurcated, variegated reality. But we understand that all of those things ultimately have their origin in something that's metaphysically simple. Because we all take our origin from God, God is at the root of our being. Anything that I can say about a concrete particular object can be traced back in a unitary way to God. That includes things like my intellect, my will, you know, my predilection for Colombian coffee. I mean, all these things ultimately explainable, you know, in terms of one simple common essence and principle, right? Therefore, if I predicate, you know, God is behind my intellect, God's behind my will, God's behind my preference for coffee, you know, God must like koala bears, whatever it might be, right? All those things are ultimately unified in one place, And so that's what we use, this language of God's intellect being the same as his will, being the same as his whatever, because we're looking at aspects of our existence, namely our intellect, our will, our whatever, and saying they find their unity ultimately in that single principle. But if you try to translate that into imagining that God has an intellect like you do, or that God has a will like you do, or that God likes koala bears the way you do, then it breaks down into unintelligibility.
Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. Pick up the phone and give us a call, 833-288-3986. Tara has a question, Dr. Anders. She has emailed to us. And this is a question that every evangelical who has ever answered an altar call and become quote-unquote born again is probably asking at this very moment.
Do you know for sure you're going to go to heaven when you die?
Almost that good, but okay. Not quite. Why does the Catholic Church make you wait until Easter to get baptized? And does that prevent salvation in the case of an accident or sudden death?
Oh, I love this question. This is a great question.
Told you.
So there's so many ways I could answer this. Let me take it from this angle. If you are an evangelical, you think of salvation as a private transaction between your soul and God. That's the way you think about it. And the important thing is to make sure the transaction takes place. That is not at all the way Scripture talks about salvation, and it's not at all the way the Catholic Church thinks about it. That first of all, we're saved ultimately by having the imprint of Christ's character on our persons. You know, people ask Catholics, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus? And the answer to that is absolutely yes, but the way Catholics understand that is so much more profound than just, you know, hey, Jesus is my co-pilot that I get to chat with when I'm having coffee. Jesus is, it's like the union between clay and a mold. That's the nature of the union that the Catholic has with Christ, or aspires to, that I be shaped and formed into Christ's image. And that image expresses itself in charity, right? And so to think of being saved apart from there being a communion of people with whom I can share love and self-sacrifice is unintelligible. I can't be saved apart from my neighbors. To do so is to think an oxymoron, right? To be saved is to love your neighbor as Christ loves his neighbor. It's to love the poor as Christ loves the poor. That's what the transformation looks like that is salvation. St. Augustine once said, God gave us the church so we would have people to do good to, right? And so the means of grace, the way that Christ shapes us and forms us, is specifically by inserting us into his body, which is the church, and allowing that ecclesial reality to work upon our personality in the sacraments, in the laws and disciplines, in the doctrines, and in the relationships that we form, particularly of charity and doing well to one another, that shapes and forms us after the likeness and image of Christ, by which process we are progressively saved more and more and more and more and more, right? That process does not begin at baptism. That process begins with the secret call of God upon your heart that we call prevenient grace. When you enter into discernment in the rite of Christian initiation or the order of Christian initiation, you are, in an extended sense, already within the Catholic Church. You belong to an order within the church. The concept of there being orders in the church is something that is foreign to the Protestant way of thinking about the church, particularly if you think of the church as an invisible association of people who have all made the private transaction with God and happen adventitiously to land on the same place on Sunday. That's not the way the Catholic Church thinks about it. The church is a visible society held together by orders, right, of which the catechumen, in which the catechumen finds himself, in one of those, right? And so the work of grace has already begun in your life. You know what St. Paul said? He who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion to the day of Christ Jesus. So you are not outside of God's grace. Now you move progressively towards full communion with the church, and then over your lifetime towards deeper and deeper communion with Christ. But at no point in there do we arbitrarily draw a line like you do as an evangelical and go, saved on this side of the line, damned on this side of the line. It doesn't work that way.
833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Congratulations to two of our great EWTN radio affiliates, Prayer Well Educational Association in Harlingen, Texas. you know, these great people that have heeded Mother Angelica's call to start these AM and FM radio stations. You know, we deal with them on a regular basis, and we know the call letters of their stations and their taglines and everything, but what the actual nonprofit was called that they formed is lost on us, and sometimes I see these names and I think, who is this? And then they tell me where it's at, and I'm like, oh, yeah, Mike or Bob or Joan or, you know. But anyway, the good folks in Harlingen, Texas, 9 years as an EWTN affiliate, and St. Paul Radio in Augusta, Georgia, also covering McCormick, South Carolina, right across the border. They're celebrating 14 years as an EWTN affiliate. Congratulations to Michael Schwartz and John Prohaska from all of us here at EWTN. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still some open lines for you at 833-288-3986. So Stan has followed up on his initial text, and he says, if God the Father didn't suffer during the crucifixion, was he pleased by Christ's obedience?
Okay, thanks. So the language of sacred scripture speaks that way. It talks about the Father being pleased with the obedience of Christ. Acts chapter 2, Philippians chapter 2 in particular use this kind of language. Now, I can imagine where you're going with this, which is that if God is impassible, it doesn't have emotions, can't suffer except in the humanity of Christ, well, then how can he possibly be pleased, right? And so I get where you're going with that. Now, here's the way the Catholic would look at that. Anytime we predicate anything of God, whether it's pleasure or wrath or what have you, we are using analogous language, and oftentimes we're using figurative language. To convey, let me take a similar example, the idea of speaking about God's wrath. Well, you know, technically, if you want to get down, you know, metaphysically about it, God can't be wrathful the way we understand wrath because, you know, God doesn't have cortisol. God doesn't, you know, he doesn't have neurotransmitters. God doesn't have a physical body, is not prone to that kind of neurological responsiveness. God's not going to undergo change. And so, you know, he can't move from, say, a passive state to an angry state to a peaceful state because God doesn't have states, right? He doesn't move like that. So when we say that God's angry, what do we mean? What are we really trying to communicate? We're trying to communicate the idea that our actions have alienated us from God. Now, if God is goodness itself, being itself, wisdom itself, beauty itself, nothing's clearer to me than that there are actions that I can perform in my own life due to my own free will that take me far from those inner dispositions, right? I mean, I can through my own anger, through my own lust or pride or greed or laziness or whatever, I can become alienated from all that is good, true, and beautiful in the world, in my own nature, in the nature of my neighbor, in the nature of reality. And if I'm alienated from myself and from my neighbor and living a life of dissipation, I become miserable. Right, I become guilt-ridden. I feel bad about myself. Life begins to fall apart at the edges. And to talk about God being wrathful is really a metaphorical way of discussing the reality that all of us have of alienating ourselves from our own best interest, right, when we act against rationality, which is, according to St. Thomas, the rule of right reason is the rule of human acts. In the same way, if I talk about, you know, God having sort of a positive passion towards me, be the flip side of that, right? I'm now becoming, you know, in touch with the goodness that is human nature, the goodness that is my neighbor, the goodness that is God himself in a way that rectifies me and elevates me and, you know, moves me beyond myself to something that's greater than myself, and goodness, truth, and beauty begin to be like the operating principle of my life, right? And that's the way the Catholic Fathers of the Church think of these things. That's the way we talk about them. That's what we mean when we use language like God's wrath, God's pleasure. Not that there are emotional movements within the Godhead, but that's a shorthand way of talking about our connection to reality as such and all that's good, true, and beautiful.
Pearl in New York called in. She wasn't able to hold on the line, but she says, why is it necessary to be baptized on Easter?
It's not necessary to be baptized on Easter, right? It's common to be baptized at Easter. Because, you know, Easter is the principal feast of the church. It is a traditional time for people to enter the Catholic Church after the penance of Lent and the period of preparation that would go into catechetical formation. It's a highly appropriate time to come into the Catholic Church. It is not the only time to come into the Catholic Church. I myself joined the Catholic Church in November, arbitrarily on the birthday of the priest who confirmed me.
Linda is going to lead things off for us today, listening in the great state of Illinois, listening on the EWTN app. Linda, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question, I hope I can word it correctly so you can understand, but I had an aunt who was a nun, and she was a very holy woman, and I loved being around her. We all know priests, you know, who that's their vocation and that's their life, is completely dedicated to God. Then I feel like, okay, then there's the rest of us who are Catholics or, you know, or even Christians, living in the world, husbands, wives, working jobs in secular society. It almost seems more challenging. I don't want to downplay what the priests and religious do, but how do you live your faith when you have to live in the secular world? I guess that's
my
question.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. So let me start actually by challenging the idea that it is easier for priests and religious to be holy. I want to challenge that idea. The church has always valorized consecrated virginity, the vows of perfection, poverty, chastity, obedience, living in religious community. This is a high calling in Catholic life. It is not a guarantee of holiness. It's not a guarantee of holiness. If a person might obtain greater holiness in that calling, it's not because it's easier to do so. It's because it's harder to do so. There are priests who wear themselves out in service to the Catholic community. I know such priests. There are also priests who look at the priesthood as a sinecure and a good way to play golf 5 days a week and only work on Sundays. I have met those priests as well. The former, rather than the latter, are coming to holiness through the vocation to priesthood. Same thing with being a religious. It is possible to live as a religious and take that form of life as an opportunity to do a tremendous amount of good to other people. It's also very possible, this is something that Thomas Merton points out in his a lot of his religious writing about the religious life. He was a Trappist monk, of course, who's well known in American circles. The strong temptation of the religious to put on the habit and then say to himself, I'm wearing the habit. I'm a priest. I'm a religious. Look how good I am. And I mean, that's an attitude that Christ constantly condemns. You know, don't aspire to the title rabbi and have men greet you with respect in marketplaces. It's so easy when you are wearing the habit or the clerical collar to fall into that temptation of people call me father, right? And to think that your holiness comes, you know, from your dress or your vocation rather than from the love with which you live out that vocation, right? So it can be actually quite challenging to come to holiness in those realms because of that. I mean, the priests that I know that I think are holy are the ones that go out of their way to say yes whenever they're asked to do something, right? I have this priest my wife and I know. We call him, you know, Father Yes. Because, Father, you want to come say Mass? Yes. You want to come hear confessions? Yes. You want to come over for dinner? Yes. You want to come bless my kids? Yes. I said, how do you do this? And he said, I don't want to lose my vocation. God called me to be a priest, to serve the people of God. I'm going to die doing that, right? But not every priest takes that attitude. Now, to the question, how do you live your vocation as a layperson in the world? Well, first of all, what is your vocation, right? If you are a married person, the church is very clear that your primary vocation is to your married life and to your family. And that means that attitude that priest has, right, that says, I'm going to wear myself out in service to the people of God, that becomes your attitude towards your family as your domestic church.
Right? Spouse first.
Spouse first.
Spouse first.
Spouse first, followed by kids, right? And the biggest difference, I think, in the Catholic doctrine of marriage compared to many other views is it is not about you. It's about the community that you bring into existence through the coupling of this man and this woman and the children that they, you know, if God grants them, may bring into the world. And your self-sacrifice on behalf of those other people to bring them to God, to bring them to holiness, to bring them to maturity, you know, to care for them when they're sick, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is your principal path to holiness. And it's by living that with generosity that you then witness to all the people around you what is meant by the love of Christ. And, you know, not everyone can do this because you may have a home where, you have some extraordinary situation going on. But there are homes, there are Catholic homes, where living that vocation, then that home becomes a kind of refuge to all the orphaned people around them. And I don't just mean those, you know, without actual biological parents. I mean all those people that don't have a place to go at Christmas and Easter or Thanksgiving or weekends or whatever. And you give rest and refreshment. You know, they say in Africa, if I'm not mistaken, elephants can smell water, you know, like miles away. They go tromping across the fields, the plains, and then they hit those massive trunks and they dig a giant water hole. And then all the other animals, all the whole ecosystem comes and drinks from the water hole that the elephants dig. You know, you can be that, you can be like a spiritual elephant digging a reservoir of grace that then all your neighbors and friends can come refresh themselves. Now, what if you're not married? What if you're a single person? Sometimes people want to know, well, you know, is there such a thing as a vocation to singleness? Well, the mere state of not being married is not a vocation. Right. I mean, that's because there's no settled form of service to your neighbor or to the church implied by the absence of marriage. But there are clearly some people who say, you know what, as long as I'm in the unmarried state, I'm going to make this an opportunity to bring grace into the world and to my neighbor. If I'm at work, you know, maybe I'm limited in what I can say about my Christian faith, but there's still ways that I can manifest the goodness of God to my neighbors. And my father, for example, was a practicing attorney, transactional attorney, in a kind of cutthroat world where he once told me, he says, David, if I limited my law practice to Christians, I would starve to death, right? So the people he represented and worked with and interacted with on a daily basis were not necessarily the most moral people, but he could be honest in that context. You know, when he would travel out of town to go to work, you know, on a case in another town, sometimes he'd be traveling with other attorneys, and they may be married guys, but they would hop in a cab and say, let's go over here to this gentleman's club. And if my father was in the cab, he'd say, stop the cab right now and let me out. I'm not going there. You know, I'm a married guy. I'm faithful to my wife. It got to the point that when he was a senior partner, they would try to pick on the young guys and be like, you want to come to the gentleman's club? And if they were Christian guys, they didn't want to do that. They'd say, tell you what I'll do. If you get Anders to go, I'll go. And, it's a lost cause. It's a lost cause. You know, so he had a reputation as a person who wasn't going to be unfaithful to his wife. And he stood for that in a way that provided moral cover to the people around him. You know, I had a granddad who was in the car rental business. He owned his own small car rental company in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And he was renowned for being honest, for having integrity, for giving people a second chance, for being fair to his employees. And so when he died, people came out of the woodwork and said, you know, that man had more integrity than anybody ever met in my life. And he wasn't preachy, right? He was just good, just manifested goodness. Don't undersell the power of an overcoming life. You know, Mother Teresa wasn't trying to make converts. She was trying to help the sick and the poor. But in just living her vocation of active charity, she brought many people to the Catholic faith. So many people have a stereotype about Catholics. Well, Catholics are judgmental, or Catholics are legalistic, or Catholics are superstitious, or whatever. When I was in college, and I was not yet discerning Catholicism, I was still sort of vehemently anti-Catholic, I had a Catholic friend who lived on our hall. And the only discernibly Catholic thing about him was that he wore a crucifix. And if you asked him, he would tell you that he was a Catholic, and he'd gone to a Catholic high school, and he loved the Jesuit priests that taught him. All right. That's not what stood out about him. What stood out was every other guy in the freshman class was just getting stupid drunk every weekend and chasing girls. And this one guy wouldn't do that. Like, he kept himself, he wasn't a prude, right? He wasn't obnoxious about it. He just was better. And it was years later reflecting on it, I was like, he lived that way because of his Catholic faith. That was a witness to me that impressed me. You know, living in the world, living in a college dormitory in New Orleans, Louisiana, here was a Catholic guy who, because of the integrity in his faith, like, kept himself, as the scriptures say, unsullied by the world.
Does that give you a little bit of encouragement, Linda? All right, well, let's hope that it did. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Still time for your phone calls on a Tuesday edition of EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy is heard right here on EWTN Radio every weekday morning at 5 a.m. Eastern Time. You can join Catholics around the world as we recall in prayer the devotion of St. Faustina to our Lord. It's the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, 5 a.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. And coming up next, Open Line with Father Wade Menezes on many of these EWTN stations. Received a text from Joe, and he's watching on YouTube, and he says, what does it mean the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak?
Oh, it means that we find it hard to do what we know we ought to do. And there's an extended reflection on this in St. Paul's letter to the Romans, 7th chapter, when he says, you know, there is a law at work in my mind. There is the law of God. And then there is another law that I perceive in my members, the law of my flesh. And in my mind, I agree with the law of God. Why don't I do it? Right? Oh, wretched man that I am, who will rescue me from this body of death? In the ancient world, there was a major transition that took place someplace between maybe the 7th and the 4th centuries BC, when we move from, you know, a Bronze Age world and Bronze Age religion, which is, you know, basically temple sacrifices, a priesthood, and the objective is how do I get the gods to smile upon my temporal enterprises, my warfare, my crops, my fertility, these sorts of things. And then there's a transition that takes place, kind of in world religion, not just in the Hebrew world, but in the Hellenistic world, in the Indian world, in the Chinese world, where people begin to realize that, you know, more than the sun, moon, and stars, you know, and their influence on the crops, what really seems to affect human flourishing most is what we do to ourselves, right? That we have, in our inner world, we have contrary principles, tendencies at work. Plato, in the Republic, goes into this at great depth. He says, you know, you've got the man, the lion, and the beast. Right, these three parts of human personality, the reason, and then the spirited appetite, and then my passions. And the whole Republic, about a book about justice, is about how to bring those three things into alignment so that I get the beast in my stomach and the lion in my chest to follow the man in my head who knows the right thing to do. So this is not just Christians who are making this discovery. It's really, you find it throughout what are called the Axial Age religions and philosophies. And it's ultimately what led St. Augustine of Hippo to the Catholic faith, because Augustine grew up in Hellenistic and Roman philosophy. He was keenly aware of the call to the noble life and the philosophical life and the life of reason in the mind and the control of the passions. And he's like, that's good. I agree with that. Where are the women at? Right? And he was a sex addict. And it used to frustrate him to no end that he could see the good. He couldn't do it. He couldn't live by it. And he went to a friend's house one time. And while he was at the friend's house and basically on the coffee table, I don't think they had coffee then, but they did have tables, he saw a copy of a book, and it was The Life of St. Anthony by Athanasius the Great, right? And he picks up The Life of St. Anthony. He starts to read it, and he says, he's astonished that Anthony is an illiterate. He doesn't have a philosophical education. He never read Cicero. He never read Seneca, right? He never read Plato. He never read Aristotle. He heard the gospel. And Anthony, this untutored, unlettered man, moved by the grace of Christ, here is the command of Jesus, if you want to be perfect, go sell everything, give to the poor, come and follow me. And he does it. And he had money. He divested himself of his possessions. He settled his sister in a convent. Off he goes to the desert, and he begins, you know, Egyptian monasticism. And Augustine reflects on that, and he turns to his friend, and he says, how is it that here we are with all our education, all our Greek philosophy, and we're wallowing in the sins of the flesh? And these untutored Christians who don't know anything are like beating us black and blue in the moral life. There's something to this Christian thing. And then finally, in a fit of frustration sometime later, he throws himself on the mercy of God, seeks baptism, and says, let me realize in my own life this thing that my head can't get wrapped around. And he wrote a book about it called On True Religion, in which he said, you know what was so great about Christianity for me, Augustine, he says, as a Platonist, I knew the right thing to do, but I couldn't do it. Christianity, Jesus Christ, delivered to the masses, right, what the Platonic philosophers only dreamed of, right? Which is this conquering of the passions through the person of Jesus as Christ becomes imprinted on my personality. St. Paul talks about having the mind of Christ, right? Well, that's what every ancient philosopher wanted. They wanted to be able to transform their mind in such a way that they could conquer the flesh and confront the problem of suffering. Christianity said, we're going to give you meaning in suffering, and we're going to give you a way to deal with the stirrings of the flesh so that you can do what you know you ought to do.
Mary is up next, a first-time caller in the great state of West Virginia, listening on St. Paul Radio. Mary, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Thank you. I first want to say I really so appreciate your work, Dr. Anders. I think you're not just your knowledge, but your attitude and your approach. So I just want to say that up front. I'm wondering if Protestants have the same kind of feeling about communion as Catholics. So as Catholics, we don't want someone receiving communion until they fully embrace what we're doing and they understand and they accept it. Wondering, you know, and sometimes Protestants will say, well, that's wrong. I should be able to receive communion in the Catholic Church. So I'm wondering if Protestants think, well, anybody can receive communion. When we do our symbolic communion service, anybody can receive. Or is there ever, a thing of, well, no, you shouldn't receive unless you believe?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this is a place where Protestantism has changed a lot over the centuries. If you go back to 16th century Protestants, unambiguously, Protestants in the 16th century practiced a closed communion, right? They restricted communion far more radically than modern Catholics do, far more radically. In fact, John Calvin, who is really the theological heart of the Reformed tradition, the Presbyterian tradition, that was really the dominant intellectual force in American Christianity for a long time. Calvin, when he was 27 years old, he wrote a book called The Institutes of the Christian Religion, 1536. 1537, he gets a job in the city of Geneva, which had just gone Protestant under the preaching of William Farrell. They needed some guy with brains to come in and help him out, so they recruit Calvin to come in. And first thing Calvin wants to do is he says, okay, well, I'm fine to do that, but here's what we need to do first. We need to write a catechism. We need to ensure that everyone in the city of Geneva subscribes to the catechism that I will write. And then I need to personally investigate and interview every single Genevan citizen to assess their preparedness or their worthiness to receive Holy Communion. And I'll come on those bases. So they let Calvin come. He wrote the catechism, and then he started telling people, well, you can't come to the communion until I've assessed that you affirm the right things and live the right way. They didn't like that too much. They kicked Calvin out. So he lasted 2 years in Geneva. He runs off to Strasbourg. He becomes an assistant pastor in the church up there for a couple of years, comes back to Geneva, and then he spends the rest of his life implementing that regime, which was absolutely closed communion, very careful evaluation of the moral lives and doctrine of communicants, and actively excluding people from communion in excommunication even. And according to one historian, up to 15% of Geneva got excommunicated at one point or another during Calvin's tenure because he so actively pursued exclusion from Holy Communion for those that he didn't like or disagreed with him or what have you. That culture of hypervigilance over the sacraments continued, of course, in Puritanism, and that was central to the whole Puritan experiment. And then it got carried over into New England. And it extended not only to communion, but also to baptism. And a key question that came up early in Puritanism was, can we admit children to baptism if we don't approve of their parents? And the hardline position was, no, we'll exclude parents and children. Well, excuse me, we'll exclude children and parents from baptism if we don't like what the parents are doing. And then there was another position that came on board, which they called it the halfway covenant, whereas, well, the parents may not be all right, but we're not going to exclude the kids. And you know, the sort of the right-wing hardliner people thought, we've gone over all the way to liberalism now that we're baptizing children, you know, with unredeemed parents. Can't have that sort of thing. So that culture of sacramental exclusiveness, very much a part of the historic Protestant tradition, it is no longer that way. Now, there are a few small sects that still practice that kind of close communion, particularly in fundamentalism. What happened in Protestantism that made them more liberal with respect to the sacraments? Denominationalism happened to them, right? But that so many different Protestant sects defined that worthiness in different terms that the system broke down due to pluralism, as effectively, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't keep the thing up because everybody thought they were Orthodox. Janice Knight wrote a book called Orthodoxies in Massachusetts, all about the fact that everybody had a different orthodoxy within Puritanism, and you could just change churches and solve the problem, right?
On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, producer Pedro Quiles, our call screener Matt Gubensky, and social media maven, Mr. Ace McKay, I'm Jack Williams sitting in today for Tom Price. Thanks for tuning in. Back at it tomorrow. Until then, God bless.